Follow The Minds of Madness on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, or wherever you get your podcasts to listen to our episodes early and ad-free and get access to monthly exclusive episodes. Go to patreon.com/madnesspod. You can also hit subscribe on Apple Podcasts for ad-free episodes. We've got links in our show notes.
The opinions expressed in the following episode do not necessarily reflect those of the Minds of Madness podcast. Listener discretion is advised.
There's a moment in Patricia Highsmith, the talented Mr. Ripley, when Tom Ripley stares into a mirror and practices being someone else. Not just imitating them, becoming them. He adopts their mannerism, their smile, their way of showing concern. He's not pretending to be their friend. He's learning to become the friend they've always wanted. It's a chilling scene because it exposes an uncomfortable truth. The most effective predators don't look like predators at all. They look like saviors, confidants, or even the daughter you never had. They arrive precisely when you need them most, armed with kindness and seemingly infinite patience. But most of all, they prey on the most valuable personal asset, our trust. Some people say that trust is a currency more valuable than money. But like any currency, trust is vulnerable to theft. Because the most dangerous thieves don't break into our house or hack our bank account. They walk through the front door, smile, and ask how your day's been. Join me now as we examine the murder of Lynn Hernan, a death initially believed to be a tragic suicide. You'll learn how a routine toxicology report uncovered a sinister secret hidden in Lynn's blood, and how suspicious financial clues and her family's questions pointed detectives toward an unexpected suspect. In the fall of 2018, 62-year-old Lynn Hernan's life had become almost unrecognizable from what it once was. She spent most of her days in a recliner in her Pewaukee, Wisconsin condominium, battling a storm of mysterious symptoms that had plagued her for several years. She could barely stomach food, surviving mostly on soup, yet she still gained significant weight, making mobility increasingly more difficult. She had severe abdominal pains, gastrointestinal issues, and cataracts, which gave her chronically dry eyes, requiring the constant use of Visine eye drops. The only comforting presence in her life was 34-year-old Jesse Krzyzewski, who'd become her daily caretaker for the past few months. Jesse was the daughter of Lynn's best friend. Having no children of her own, Lynn practically adopted her. Since childhood, Jesse had always called her Auntie Lynn. But over time, Lynn began to lovingly refer to Jesse as her daughter. Two or three times each day, Jesse would check in on Lynn, handling her shopping, managing her prescription medications, and keeping track of her finances. Once upon a time, Lynn had been a firecracker, a hairstylist with a flair for the dramatic. She sported teased blonde curls, bright nail polish, high heels, and armfuls of jewelry. Her bold looks were only matched by her boisterous personality. Lynn had been a social butterfly who loved entertaining and cooking for friends. If there was an excuse to host a party, Lynn would happily volunteer. But those days were long gone. As Lynn's health deteriorated, she became increasingly reclusive. The woman who once commanded attention now refused to see visitors. She became ashamed of her appearance and didn't want anyone seeing her that way. She drank heavily, smoked 3 packs a day, and relied on Jesse for almost everything. The once vibrant beautician could hardly get out of her recliner, and doctors struggled to figure out what was behind her declining health. In late September, Lynn spent nearly 2 weeks in the hospital.
She stayed for 13 days. She had very bad watery diarrhea. She was weak. She had abdominal pain, and she was in the hospital for a long time.
Dr. Linda Podritsky lists the specialist Lynn saw during her stay at the hospital.
She saw an infectious disease specialist, a renal specialist. She saw a GI specialist. There were multiple consults that were obtained while she was in the hospital trying to figure out what her problems were and how to fix them. She's been eating soup for years, fears of GI symptoms. She's had a UTI 6 times, and 6 weeks ago took a sulfa antibiotic for a UTI.
Every time Lynn visited the doctors, it seemed like they discovered a new problem.
Interstitial myocarditis, hypertension, hepatic steatosis, and chronic obstructive pulmonary disease.
Among Lynn's health issues, doctors also suspected she'd been battling depression and recommended therapy.
Her response to this therapist was that she does not think anxiety or depression is affecting her, and she wanted to go home now that she had a diagnosis. And the conclusion was she does not want to see a psychiatrist or take any psychiatric medication.
On the morning of October 3rd, 2018, Jesse arrived at Lynn's condo for her usual check-in. As usual, Lynn was asleep in her recliner when Jesse arrived, so she woke her up and they chatted for a while. Around 10 a.m., Jesse left the condo to run some errands of her own. When she returned later that afternoon, shortly before 5 p.m., as expected, Lynn was still sitting in the exact same spot. But when Jesse tried talking to her, she got no response. Then, she checked for a pulse. She found none. Jesse immediately called 911. First responders soon arrived and confirmed what Jesse already knew. Lynn Hernan was dead. Empty prescription bottles littered the floor around her chair, and a couple of pills remained halfway chewed inside her mouth. Powder from crushed medications were visible on her chest, and a plate near her chair contained more remnants of crushed pills. It was Deputy Kelsey Mitchelson who first spoke to Jesse when she arrived.
She said that she last saw her around 10 a.m. that day when she left to go run some errands. From what I knew, Jesse was the caretaker of the individual that we were on scene with. She saw her that morning, tried to feed her some breakfast. She wasn't willing to eat. She tried to get change her. She usually sits on a Chucks pad to like collect any urine that might go on. She wanted to be left alone. Sounded like the individual that had died that day was kind of becoming more increasingly sick as the past couple of days went on, or over the past year even. And Jesse really mentioned that the person who had died was starting to decline pretty fast. She wouldn't take her meds the night before. Jesse also noticed that some of the pills had gone missing.
Because the scene in the living room was an apparent suicide, the deputy asked Jesse if she believed Lynn had been suicidal.
Jesse's answer was yes and no. I know she loves her cats and was always worried about them, but she was tired of being sick and tired of not being able to get around like she used to.
In the days following Lynn's death, everything seemed to support the conclusion that she'd taken her own life. The scene itself, with the crushed pills and empty prescription bottles, painted a picture that made sense to everyone. A tragic ending of a life worn down by chronic illness and isolation. But there was one person who felt this sense of nagging doubt.
No, I would say that's atypical. Usually when people overdose on their medications, they still swallow them.
Deputy Medical Examiner Tabitha Kooks explains how she'd never seen half-chewed pills in the mouth of a suicide victim. The crushed-up powder on Lynn's chest was also concerning.
I have had cases where people were snorting particular medications to get that effect faster, but I would imagine most of us would have a very difficult time trying to snort off of our own chest, so that doesn't really explain that for me. There's also some very large pieces there that would be difficult to snort, so, and with the piece in her mouth, then it looks more like she's eating them, and I don't have an explanation for why, if she was eating them, so much would be on her chest.
During Lynn's autopsy, great care was taken to collect the dust from Lynn's clothing. Chief Medical Examiner Dr. Podritsky agreed it seemed suspicious.
There was a sprinkling of multicolored pill fragments on her body, in her hair, on her chest, over her shoulders. I mean, literally, the only thing I thought of when I saw this was somebody, you know, held crushed pills and just like sprinkled them like confetti. I've never seen that in a case before.
The powdery substance was tested and confirmed to be the combination of prescription medications that Lynn had in her possession. They took blood samples and sent them to a lab for toxicology testing. Everyone expected to find the same lethal levels of these same drugs. But when Dr. Podritsky received the tox report back, she encountered something she'd never seen before in her career.
There was a substance that I was unusual, an unusual finding that I hadn't seen in a report from their facility before. It was called tetrahydrazoline. I mean, many of the findings in their toxicology report were things that I was familiar with and were found in her investigation in terms of the medication she had access to. But tetrahydrazoline just sort of came out of nowhere. So I called them and I said, you know, what's your experience with this? Should I send another specimen? Can we confirm it through another means? Because this is an unexpected result.
The tox report confirmed that Lynn had an array of prescription drugs in her system. But surprisingly, they were all within the normal therapeutic levels, nowhere near enough to cause death. The only extreme outlier was tetrahydrazoline, the active ingredient in Visine eye drops. Dr. Podritsky consulted a forensic toxicologist to find out more about this chemical.
Typically, when it's used as an eye drop, the concentration is less than 1 nanogram per milliliter. The concentration found in the blood specimen collected at autopsy was over 400 times higher than the highest concentration that's been reported following the use of tetrahydrazoline as an eye drop.
The only way for a person to have that much of the drug in their system would be to ingest it. Dr. Podritsky describes the effect this would have on a person.
The main symptoms affect the brain and the heart. So there are symptoms of drowsiness, lethargy, coma, stopping breathing, and then for the heart, low heart rate, low blood pressure, and heart block. So the seriousness of the effects of tetrahydrazoline reflected by the symptoms that are documented is not consistent with it being harmless. And I certainly do think it can be fatal. And there is, if not medically reviewed literature, there is legal documentation of its ability to cause death.
It turned out there was little to no medical research on the lethality of tetrahydrazoline if ingested in large quantities. There was, however, a previous murder case involving the drug.
This case involves a woman who admitted to dosing her husband with tetrahydrazoline and initially told investigators it was a natural death. However, his blood was tested, and it was a coroner's case, and 68 nanograms per ml of tetrahydrazoline was found in his blood. And upon later questioning, the wife stated, yes, I dosed him with tetrahydrazoline. I just tried to make it look like something else. And due to her confession, she was convicted.
The amount of tetrahydrazoline found in Lynn's bloodstream was more than double this amount.
So the cause of death I determined was tetrahydrazoline poisoning. I also determined that there were other significant conditions, a number of other medications, including baclofen, ropinirole, alprazolam, hydrocodone, and cyclobenzaprine use. Then I have to determine a manner of death, and I determined it was a homicide, which is a medical determination, not based on law enforcement or criminal rules. It's a public health determination, actually. And how this injury occurred is that she was given tetrahydrazoline by another, which is why I called it a homicide.
In January 2019, Dr. Podrytsky informed detectives of her conclusion. By then, the Waukesha County Sheriff's Department had already developed their own suspicions about Lynn's death. One of Lynn's friends had contacted police in December and told them he didn't believe Lynn's death was a drug overdose. Instead, he believed Jesse Krzyzewski was somehow involved. According to him, Jesse had moved into Lynn's home, was using her belongings, and selling her property. He was particularly concerned about Lynn's Jeep, which he believed was supposed to go to Lynn's nephew. In the same way Lynn often called Jesse her daughter, her nephew wasn't really her nephew either. Instead, he was a 21-year-old son of another one of Lynn's lifelong best friends, and his name was Anthony Poza.
I mean, from birth on up to his adulthood, she just treated him really like family.
Anthony's mom, Corrine, was Lynn's close friend.
Massive love for my son and just always wanted to be around us, said we were her family, that she didn't, you know, have kids of her own or was married. So she had a ton of fun just hanging out with us. He always called her Auntie Lenny. There wasn't one little tiny holiday that went by that she wasn't showering him with gifts and cards and food and what you name it. It was just like having, you know, that special aunt or another mom or whatever. She just did a lot of things for him that showed me, you know, really how much she loved him. Just always went above and beyond and was always thinking about him and about us.
Lynn never had much money to spare, but she was known for giving thoughtful, inexpensive gifts that left a lasting impression.
It could be any little thing, Hot Wheel cars, you know, Lego, whatever. But she was really kind of the queen of bargains. She loved to shop rummage sales and estate sales and thrift stores. She even would pick things up off the side of the road, refinish them, make beautiful pieces of furniture, fix things up. But when he was smaller, you know, I think you can entertain a kid with very inexpensive things. And he, you know, he loved that just as much because he just, you know, loved being with her.
When Lynn's parents passed away, she inherited close to $250,000. But this windfall hadn't changed Lynn's lifelong propensity to thrifty shopping. Beginning in 2016, when Lynn's health took a dramatic turn for the worse, Corrine saw less and less of her friend.
I didn't have as much contact with her. There were times that I would call her and say, hey, I'm in the area, I'm going to stop by and say hi, I haven't seen you in a long time. And she would tell me not to come, that she was not feeling well. Talked to her a little bit, trying to kind of connect with her, but she would just tell me she was not feeling well.
It was around the same time that Anthony started going to college. And because his campus was so close to Lynn's house, he made it a point to spend extra time with her.
As I got into college, I'd go and see her at her residence in Pewaukee once or twice a month. I just drive over there for lunch because I had a long lunch break, and she'd usually offer me food or whatever was in the fridge, and it's just a cool place to hang out, I guess, away from campus and, you know, but still close enough to where I could get back to class pretty quick.
One of the things Anthony always appreciated about Lynn was that she absolutely hated technology. She didn't own a computer, tablet, or even a smartphone.
She didn't have anything, really. You know, there was no sending stuff to her via email or even text message. There was none of that. You just called her. I mean, if I was there, it was pretty much one-on-one. You know, that was what was nice, is kids in my generation are always on their phones, so it's like not having a person to talk to, and you could always talk to Lynn, absolutely.
Eventually, Anthony switched schools, and the lunchtime hangouts with Lynn came to an end. Still, he tried to see her whenever possible.
The last time I saw Lynn was a month before she passed away with my uncle. They met at my uncle's house, and I live really close by, and I walked up there, and she looked pretty good, and we talked for a while, and that was the last time I saw Lynn. She said she was starting to feel better, and you know, she did complain about back problems and certain things before that, and she's like, I'm finally, you know, I'm glad I'm getting out again, and you know, we need to do this more often. And I didn't think it was like the last time by any stretch of the imagination.
Anthony learned about Lynn's passing on October 4th, the day after she died.
She had called me to say that, you know, Lynn Herndon had passed away and that I was on this will and that, you know, that we'd have to get together in the next couple days.
The person who called Anthony to break the news was Jesse Krzyzewski, a person he'd never met before. Lynn's will had made Jesse and Anthony co-beneficiaries of her estate, with Jesse acting as the estate's representative.
I didn't want to talk about any of that. I was devastated. I mean, we all just were pretty shocked. Lynn would bring that up to me when I'd go see her in college, and I usually shut the conversation down because it was just kind of awkward. I wanted her here, not any of her things. I mean, and as far as I knew, she didn't have that much stuff. I knew I was on her will, but I didn't know to what degree. It's always like really, you know, we'd be in the middle of a conversation and she would, you know, talk to me about money she put places and that if something ever happened to her to, you know, make sure to grab it. And I, like I said, it was always very awkward conversations that I honestly dismissed 95, 99% of the time.
At Jesse's request, Anthony went over to Lynn's apartment to discuss the estate.
I was a little distressed. I wasn't really thinking about stuff as much as I was just kind of thinking about what had happened. And of course, I walked through it because it was more of, you know, a memory of our friend. And I took some of her parents' things from like World War II, some dog tags and, you know, a little box of just mementos from her family because I was close with her dad when I was a little kid, and he would tell me stories about World War II, so that stuff was important to me. I had a little box, and they said, hey, could I grab this stuff? And Jesse said that was fine.
As the weeks went by, however, Anthony began thinking about some of Lynn's more valuable possessions, wondering what had become of them.
I asked about certain things that were like higher ticket items toward like later in the month, and I said, you know, what are you going to do with this? And she had a bracelet that, to my knowledge, was supposed to be given to my uncle.
Jesse told Anthony it made more sense to just sell the bracelet instead. Anthony then asked about Lynn's Jeep, but Jesse claimed Lynn had signed the vehicle over to Jesse's mother just weeks before she passed away. In January 2019, right around the same time it was confirmed that Lynn had been murdered by poisoning, one of Lynn's cousins reached out to police with concerns of their own. They'd done some digging into Jesse's past, and what they found was disturbing. Jesse had already spent some serious time in prison on fraud and forgery convictions.
In February of 2010, Ms. Krzyzewski was working at a health clinic when several patients of that health clinic were contacted by their financial institutions to be informed that loans were being applied for in their name with their personal information.
Assistant DA Randy Sitzberger did extensive research into Jesse's past.
And it came to bear that Ms. Krzyzewski was using her position as a receptionist to steal these individuals' information and apply for 8 different loans. For that conviction, along with several others that she was sentenced for at the same time, involved essentially a shell game using different vehicles and using those as leverage to obtain title loans from title loan companies. She received 1 year of initial confinement. Then in July of 2010, used her own mother's identification to try and obtain a loan from Payday Loans. When the police came and confronted Ms. Krzyzewski, she tried to convince the officers who were speaking with her that she was her 46-year-old mother. Then, in September of 2010, after stealing from her mother, she went to live with a friend, Ms. Krzyzewski, who was not working, pretended to be that victim when calling the financial institution to add herself to that victim's account, and tried to obtain loans there as well. In yet another case of forgery in October of 2010, she was found to have been passing bad checks. She served her confinement time until release on October 9th of 2012. By December 9th, 2013, she was again placed on a hold for a fraud offense and was officially sent back to prison until February 23rd of 2016.
Between the ages of 26 and 32, Jessie had spent nearly half of that time behind bars for forgery, theft, and fraud. Some of Lynn's family and friends were starting to wonder, was it really a coincidence? Lynn's health began seriously deteriorating at almost the exact same time Jessie got out of prison. Detectives began looking into Lynn Hernan's financial history and found that she lived most of her life scraping by from paycheck to paycheck. Even after inheriting $250,000 from her parents in 2014, she stuck to her frugal ways, rarely using credit cards and always paying them off. But in 2016, everything changed. Her credit cards were suddenly maxed out. Her online purchases skyrocketed, even though Lynn didn't own a computer and avoided technology like the plague. Her money market account, which held most of her parents' inheritance, was being drained by large withdrawals. By the time of her death, it only had $87 left in it. Toward the end of her life, Lynn's financial activity looked nothing like the previous 62 years. It did, however, bear a striking resemblance to someone else's spending patterns, Jessie Krzyzewski's, whom detectives learned had developed a serious gambling addiction. But the spending spree didn't end when Lynn died. Something Anthony Poza was about to uncover.
Came to be like March of 2019, and that's when I started thinking about like what had happened, and the estate, I think, was finally starting to close up, and I was starting to get things from what I believed was Lynn's attorney with, you know, final account bills and stuff. I just remember getting a final account with just a bunch of credit card bills and condo improvement, like, receipts, and it was just not like Lynn, because I knew Lynn didn't have a credit card, and it was just weird how she had all these debts that just didn't make any sense to me. I went through some of the receipts that didn't match the final account statement. She assured me that, you know, on every single one, she assured me that this was, you know, that Lynn had all this credit card debt, and that, you know, the final account statement, like, for the entire estate was, I think, $26,000, which I thought was strange considering her house was $145,000, and I just, it's hard to believe that she had that much debt.
According to Jessie, Lynn had acquired so much debt that it had taken almost the entire value of the estate to pay it off. Anthony's share of the estate came to a grand total of $13,000. He knew this couldn't be right, so he hired an attorney to look into it.
He called me in the spring of 2019 and let me know that he was a beneficiary of an estate and he had some questions and maybe concerns about what was going on with that estate. So there are $100,000, some of those are medical bills, but almost $100,000 of credit card debt, which is pretty unusual for an older woman who, by all accounts, didn't leave the house much. It's not just the amount of the debt, it's the amount of the debt relative to her assets. So only after selling her condo was there enough money to even approach paying all these bills? And does somebody run up credit card debt that's more or close to the equity in their condo or house? It just struck me as unusual.
Despite the suspicious financial activity surrounding Lynn and Jesse, detectives couldn't prove anything illegal had occurred. If Lynn had willingly funneled all her money to Jesse during her final years, no laws would have been broken. And that likely would have been the way things stayed forever, except for one thing. Jesse kept calling the sheriff's office over and over to ask if they'd gotten the results back from Lynn's toxicology report.
I just want to know, like, because they kind of, like, weren't sure. We didn't know if it was a suicide or if it was something medical. She was in the hospital shortly before. She's been sick for years. We really weren't sure, you know, if this is something, because the doctors could never figure out what was going on. Mm-hmm. You know, it's kind of frustrating because I was there all the time, taking care of her. I'm the one who took her to the doctor. I'm the one who did everything. So the not knowing, you know, and I wasn't there with
her. There is a medical issue.
So it bothers me because I go, could I have been there? Could I have helped? Could I have done something? You know, that's my hardest part. I've never found anybody before, and it's not something I ever want to do again.
Detectives then began looking into Anthony's claims that Jesse was stealing from Lynn's estate, and they discovered Jesse had created an elaborate web of false documents. She'd fabricated receipts showing payments to debts that never existed. Instead, they revealed that Jesse had stolen almost $90,000 from the estate. Then she used the money to pay off her own debts, as well as spending tens of thousands of dollars at the casinos. On July 9th, detectives arrested Jesse for violating her parole by gambling at casinos. The reality, however, was that her arrest was a pretext to interrogate her about the death of Lynn Hernan.
The day of her death, did you remember if you gave her pills that day?
No. And I remember before I left, I asked her, like, are your pills taken for the day? Do you need water? Do you need this? Do you need that? Mm-hmm. And no, she said she was fine. I said, oh, I'll be back in a couple hours. I just want to get the stuff done. And she was, like, pushing me to go.
Jesse was telling the same story she already told police, that she hadn't given Lynn any medications that morning.
And there's an anomaly in her toxicology. There's a drug in her system that's not supposed to be there.
And what would that be?
It's called tetrahydrazine.
What is that?
It's eye drops.
She uses eye drops all the time.
What does she use them for?
She uses them for her eyes. But yeah. She went through them like crazy, which didn't make sense.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Like, when you say a lot, how much was she using?
I probably brought her 4 bottles while she was in the hospital.
Apparently, it's not good for you to use lots of eye drops. And that's what the medical examiner is concerned about. Did you ever see her, like spritz the stuff in her mouth?
No.
This interaction was the first time Jesse learned what had been found in Lynn's toxicology report. And it was the first time the word tetrahydrozoline had ever been mentioned to her.
What killed her is the eye drops.
Are you serious?
You do think someone would have went in there and tried to kill her with eye drops?
No.
Put it in her, drink?
I swear to God, I
don't. Her vodka? Does anyone have a motive?
No. No, this would be all her. She knew what she was doing, obviously. Lynn was very determined to go out on her own way. She was determined to do things her way.
The medical examiner tends to think someone killed her.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
Why is that?
Because they didn't find any Visine bottles next to her.
They're all over her house.
But she didn't really move around. The medical examiner thinks someone was giving this to her. In an attempt to kill her. She has a lot of it in her.
What do you mean a lot?
A lot. Like, not enough. You can't take it through your eyes. It has to be ingested.
I've never seen her drink it. Ever. Ever. And why would she drink eye drops? I find that very weird.
So medical examiner thinks the body was staged.
I was the only one there, and I didn't stage her body. I'm not lying. I was the only one there.
The detective noticed that Jesse's story was starting to change. Whereas before, Jesse stated she was unsure of whether or not Lynn had been suicidal. But now she was adamant that Lynn had been, quote, very determined to go out in her own way. The next day, on July 10th, Jesse asked to speak with detectives again. This time she confessed that Lynn had been drinking cocktails of Visine and vodka during her last days.
On Monday, and she was drinking vodka and Visine.
Now, how do you know she was drinking vodka and Visine?
Because that's what she had mixed together. And that was the day before.
How do you know she had mixed Visine with her vodka?
Because that's what she did. She's done it about three times.
Why didn't you tell us that yesterday?
Because I didn't want to tell you guys. And I'm getting tired of being put on you because I didn't.
You never put the vodka in her Visine.
Never.
So she put Visine in her vodka. Why would she put Visine in her vodka?
Because she wanted something with it.
And Visine's the option?
No. She was looking for her way out. And because she tried pills twice and it wasn't working.
Extra Value Meals are back. That means 10 tender juicy McNuggets and medium fries and a drink are just $8. Only at McDonald's.
For limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. Prices may be higher in Hawaii, Alaska, and California and for delivery.
The next day, Jesse admitted even more. This time, giving Lynn a bottle of water she knew had Visine mixed into it.
And she said, "So one bottle I have left on the right. Can you please give me that before you leave?" I honestly thought, though, like the other times, it wasn't going to kill her. I thought it was going to put her sick for a little bit. And when I went to leave, she said, "I want that bottle." And I said, "You don't need it." I figured it would put her to sleep because she was putting in very large doses.
Jesse told detectives that Lynn had been struggling with suicidal thoughts for some time. She even revealed that she once walked in on Lynn holding a pistol to her head. And then Jesse made another shocking claim, that she'd save evidence proving Lynn was suicidal just in case anyone tried blaming her for Lynn's death. According to Jesse, she had Lynn's gun, as well as a tape recording of Lynn that would prove everything.
Now you're saying that you have evidence that can validate your claim that Lynn was trying to hurt herself and that she basically was enlisting your help to do that. Now you're saying that you have evidence of that. Explain to me why that you're so against showing us.
I'm not against it. I just am not ready yet. That's what it is. I'm not against it. I'm really not. I just don't know. I guess I don't. I'm not ready yet. I'm not too concerned, but you guys wouldn't find it without me.
Women, you won't find it without you.
It's hidden. Done. Hidden.
So you don't want to tell us where you buried this stuff?
No, I'll tell you.
Where'd you bury it?
It's in Whitnall Park.
Whitnall Park?
It's behind my mom's.
Detectives didn't believe for a second that Jesse had buried a box of evidence that would exonerate her in Lynn's murder. Still, Detective Aaron Hoppe orchestrated a search for the mysterious box.
We had multiple detectives on scene at Whitnall Park. I believe we had two metal detectors. So we were going through the area where Ms. Krzyzewski had pointed to on a map and had best described the area where she had buried these items. Our detectives were combing through that area looking for any freshly dug or disturbed dirt. And then obviously utilizing the metal detectors, attempting to locate the gun pieces that we were specifically looking for. During this time, we had a live feed, a FaceTime feed over an iPad, where we and Ms. Krzyzewski were in the conference room, and detectives on scene were kind of giving us an idea of where they were at, and we were trying to best have Ms. Krzyzewski explain where this possibly could be.
Detectives made multiple attempts to locate the buried box, but of course, no box was ever found. After Jesse's arrest, detectives spoke to Jesse's boyfriend, Scott Craig, who revealed that Jesse's deceptions went far deeper than anyone had imagined.
We were boyfriend and girlfriend for 3 years, 3.5 years. For the majority of the time, she was living with me. When I first met Jesse,
Throughout those first few months, she told me of a friend of hers that was like a mother figure, and her name was Lynn. I didn't really know anything else. I knew she lived in Pewaukee. Jesse talked to her a few times a week on the phone, went and visited her. So I just knew of her as a good, close friend of Jesse's.
According to Scott, he'd never even met Lynn. He told police that Jesse began spending more and more time with Lynn in the spring of 2018. The reason for the increased attention was because, according to Jesse, Lynn had fallen into a coma that had lasted 5 months.
She said that Lynn was a drinker. She used pills before medications. I don't know if they were prescribed or not. She was suicidal, things of that nature. That was the reason that I was told that she was in a coma, because of pills and alcohol. And I could tell Jesse was very distraught about it.
Scott was shocked to learn that Lynn had never been in a coma. But then it was Scott's turn to surprise the police. When they told him that Lynn had died from Visine poisoning, Scott told them that Jesse had been poisoned by Visine earlier that same year.
She was out with some friends. They went to another local pub to go see a concert, and she believed that somebody had drugged her and she wasn't feeling well, and she had to go to the doctor. They said that she ingested Visine. Well, she said it was tetra something. But in the end, she clarified that it was chemical in Visine. I was very irate, very mad, wondering who could do this to her. I was inquiring on who she was with, where she was afterwards, beforehand, trying to figure out who could have done something like this to her. Very concerned that, if it was somebody, a friend of ours. I just wanted to get to the bottom of actually what happened to her.
Detectives spoke with the clinic where Jesse had supposedly been treated, but they discovered that Jesse had never been admitted nor tested for tetrahydrozoline poisoning. Just like the buried evidence box, she'd simply made the entire thing up. In October 23rd, nearly 5 years after Lynn Hernan's death, 39-year-old Jesse Krzyzewski entered the Waukesha County courtroom to stand trial. She faced three charges: intentional homicide, theft while Lynn was still alive, and theft from Lynn's estate.
At the very day of October 3rd, when police come and talk to Jesse Krzyzewski, they ask her point blank, "Do you think this could be a suicide?" And her answer was, "Well, yes or no, I don't really know. I don't think Lynn would have left her cats." While she loved cats, hated technology. Didn't own a computer, didn't own a smartphone, used a flip phone sort of when she had to, didn't use email, had no email address of her own, had no way of checking it, didn't know how to check it. She was not checking her credit card statements online. She was not checking email. She was doing nothing. Had no computer or any device to access the internet until approximately June of 2018, when Lynn's pattern of almost 2 years at that point that we can see starts to look a lot like Ms. Krzyzewski's. We know that Ms. Krzyzewski, as I said, she's earning $49,000 of legitimate income in this time, and she's spending well over $500,000. And Detective Plenis will tell you why that's important for law enforcement to recognize, that when somebody's pattern of life switches to another person's pattern of life, what does that mean? And frankly, dead at only 62 years old from a tetrahydrozoline poisoning after the defendant gave her a bottle laced with Visine eye drops to drink.
Jesse and her defense team were adamant she could never murder a person she considered family.
And if Lynn Hernan was here today, she would say, "Are you crazy? That's my daughter that you have sitting there at that desk over there. That's my daughter. She knew everything that I was doing when I was doing this. I loved her. I loved her. She's my daughter. I've known her since she was 8 or 9 years old, since she was a child. Had she known this was going to happen, I think she would have did something different. I don't think, never in her wildest dream would she ever think Jesse would get arrested for a suicide that Lynn committed or being charged with money that Lynn gave to her. Jesse's innocent."
The defense put forward experts who disagreed with the medical examiner's findings that Lynn had died from tetrahydrozoline.
It's a what is called a poly drug overdose. When somebody takes too many pills, the combination together can create exactly what happened here. These were the positive findings that came through, and look at what she has in her system. It's just incredible to see the number of drugs and the quantities of the drugs. And maybe one alone, fine, but the combination, deadly.
Over the course of 15 days, the prosecution laid out their entire case piece by piece. Jesse had been systematically draining Lynn's bank accounts for nearly 3 years. And when the balance dwindled from $250,000 to just $87, Jesse poisoned her.
The toxicology was atypical. That scene was atypical. And Dr. Bedritsky told you that it was significant to her that of all the medication, pills, and bottles, and powders at the scene, that Ms. Hernan's toxicology did not indicate elevated levels of those prescriptions. Certainly not fatal levels. There was only one poison in Ms. Hernan's toxicology, and it was eye drops, and they weren't on the scene. I submit to you, ladies and gentlemen, that the misleading scene that caused investigators from day one to believe this was a pill overdose was very intentional. Ms. Krzyzewski's intent is clear. It was to kill. The intent behind her lies is to mislead. And the motive is her own personal benefit.
The prosecution also revealed that in the summer of 2018, just months before Lynn's murder, Jesse had been doing extensive research into all kinds of chemical poisoning.
This is someone with a fair amount of poison research on her own phone. This is someone who has profited over $144,000 before death and over $80,000 after. This is someone who thought she would get away with this or be able to talk her way out of it. At the time Lynn Hernan died, she was worth more to Ms. Krzyzewski dead than alive. And this person that you heard about did not kill herself. If Lynn Hernan taking her own life was such a reasonable hypothesis, consistent with the defendant's innocence, then why did she have to lie about it? That the reason that everyone at the scene thought this was a suicide is because that was exactly Ms. Krzyzewski's intent that day. And it worked for a period of time until the toxicology came back.
In the end, the jury found Jesse Krzyzewski guilty on all charges. While Jesse was in jail, she claimed her family had miraculously discovered a collection of letters supposedly written by Lynn shortly before her death. According to Jesse, these were Lynn's suicide notes, evidence she argued that proved her innocence. One letter, allegedly addressed to Jesse, stood out. In it, Lynn confessed to poisoning her own mother years ago by putting Visine in her tea. The guilt, Jesse claimed, had consumed Lynn, leading to her depression and ultimate suicide. The letter went on to praise Jesse extensively, explaining how she was the only true friend Lynn ever had. But there was just one problem. The handwriting on the letters matched Jesse's trial notes, and surveillance video from the jail showed Jesse mailing the letters to a friend. Despite the ridiculousness of the fraudulent letters, at her sentencing in 2024, Jesse spent over an hour reading them out loud in court. Needless to say, the judge wasn't impressed.
Those letters, no way Lynn Hernan wrote those either herself or willingly. But as I saw everything, I have to ask out loud, were you poisoning Lynn Hernan all along, following your release from prison? She got markedly sicker following your reinsertion in her life on a daily basis. ultimately ending up in the hospital in September of 2018. Unexplained. Couldn't figure out what was going on. I think that gave you the green light. You said it went undetected, because what I think was happening is that you were using it to control Lynn Hernan, to steal from her, to gain control of her accounts. I think you targeted her, the perfect victim. On the first degree intentional homicide charge, count one, I'm going to impose a life sentence with the possibility of extended supervision after 30 years. That would make you close to 70 years of age. But my target is really 80 for you. That is why on counts two and three, you're going to serve maximum sentences, and that target being to make you eligible closer to a point in time when you are 80 years of age.
Lynn Hernan's life was defined by contrasts. Once, she was the life of every party, but spent her final days in solitude, confined to her recliner. But even as her health crumbled, Lynn held fast to one belief. She trusted people. Tragically, that trust was her undoing. Lynn's refusal to embrace modern technology made her an easy target to a digital fraudster like Jesse. But in a twist of irony, it was Lynn's old-school thriftness, her predictable habits, and her lifetime of consistency that ultimately led detectives to Jesse's door. Jesse Gershevsky was never a caretaker. She was a predator. She didn't see Lynn as a cherished family member. She saw her as an opportunity. Stealing Lynn's money was one thing, but taking her final moments, turning her death into a stage spectacle of pills and lies, was the ultimate betrayal. And although Jesse tried to literally rewrite Lynn's story in the end, her true legacy will always be remembered by those who never stopped believing in Lynn Hernan. Just before Jesse was sentenced to spend 40 years in prison, Anthony Poza told the courtroom just how much Lynn had meant to him and his family.
The void left by the absence of Auntie Lenny, our close friend, is immense and unfathomable. Her laughter, her kindness, her presence, these are now memories we cling to amidst the darkness of grief. The pain of Lynn's absence is not solely ours to bear. It echoes through the lives of her friends and all those who were touched by her warmth and generosity throughout her life, whether it be during the holidays or on a random afternoon or evening for an appetizer and drink. We also want to take this opportunity to share with you the humanity of Auntie Lenny. She was more than just a statistic, more than just a name in a news headline. She was a beloved friend, a cherished family member, a bright light extinguished far too soon. These are the most important things to be remembered about somebody who is deeply loved by many and taken out due to selfish greed.
Follow the Minds of Madness on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. To support the show and get access to ad-free episodes, extra content, and Patreon-exclusive episodes, go to patreon.com/madnesspod. To find us on Instagram and Facebook, search The Minds of Madness, and on Twitter using the handle @madnesspod. And also, by checking out our sponsors and using our promo codes, you're also helping support the show. We've got all the links in our episode notes. So until next week, thanks for listening.